Section 8. The Mahayana Sangha. Having deepened the conception of the Buddha nature and given a more adequate and ample interpretation of the Dharma, it would be a matter for astonishment if the Mahayana had not simultaneously broadened the basis of the Sangha. In the Hinayana Sutras, the Buddha is generally represented as expounding the doctrine to an assembly consisting chiefly of monks, and the residual impression left by such texts is that the Dharma is, on the whole, intended more for members of the monastic order than for the laity. Mahayana sutras, however, generally depict the Buddha in his Sambhogakaya preaching the Dharma to an ocean-wide assembly consisting, besides the Arhat bhikshus, of innumerable bodhisattvas, guardian kings, and gods and demigods of various orders. Sometimes the particular universe in which the assembly takes place finds difficulty in accommodating so great a multitude of beings who arrive with their respective retinues from all directions of space. Consequently, the visitors are sometimes obliged, like Milton's rebel angels, to reduce their dimensions before taking their seats. Celestial beings are, of course, among the auditors of many a Hinayana discourse. What differentiates the Mahayana from the Hinayana sutras, so far as the composition of their respective audience is concerned, is the fact that in the former, the bodhisattvas are more numerous and prominent than the arhats, and that they sometimes figure as their instructors. Moreover, all these bodhisattvas are represented iconographically as laymen, generally in the form of beautiful young princes, 16 years of age, adorned with jewel headdresses and strings of pearls. Difference of audience indicates a difference of attitude. As we have seen in section 4, the fourth of the five charges brought by the Mahayana against the Hinayana was in respect of over-attachment to the merely formal aspects of monasticism. The Mahayana, on the other hand, as was explained in section 5, while continuing to cherish the monastic ideal, gave increased importance to a dedicated household life. This difference of attitude is reflected in their respective conceptions of the Arya Sangha, or congregation of saints, of which the third of the three refuges taken by all Buddhists essentially consists. According to the Hinayanists, this spiritual aristocracy is made up exclusively of those who have entered upon the four transcendental paths, that is to say, stream winners, once returners, non-returners, and arhats, all of whom, with perhaps one or two exceptions in the lower grades, are members of the monastic order. Thus, for the Hinayana, the spiritual community is in effect a subdivision of the ecclesiastical corporation, so that both spiritually and socially, monks occupy a more prominent position than laymen. In the Mahayana, however, the Arya Sangha consists exclusively of bodhisattvas who have entered upon the second and higher series of the stages of the path to supreme enlightenment. Some of these bodhisattvas may be living as monks, others as laymen. Thus, for the Mahayana, the spiritually advanced section of the ecclesiastical corporation is only a subdivision of the spiritual community, so that spiritually at least, the position of the laity is no less prominent than that of the monks. Indeed, from the Mahayana point of view, though arhats may be reckoned as bodhisattvas of the sixth stage, laymen who have taken upon themselves the four great vows of the bodhisattva, even without having entered upon the first of the 10 stages of the path, are the spiritual superiors of monks who have made no such aspiration. Apart from the fact that even according to the Hinayana scriptures, the Buddha himself had emphasized that truth and righteousness were of far greater importance than the external habiliments of religion, two reasons may be assigned for this broadening of the basis of the Sangha by the Mahayana, with a consequent lessening of the essential difference, if not the external distinction, between monks and laymen. One is the Mahayana equation of samsara and nirvana. The other is doctrine that potentially all beings are Buddhas. Monastic life obviously involves the giving up of something. Thus it is based on a dualism between God and the world, or spirit and matter, or, in the case of Hinayana Buddhism, between the transcendental order and the mundane. By asserting that reality was the non-dual and that nirvana and samsara were not different from each other, thus relegating the whole Hinayana doctrine and discipline to the realm of not absolute, but only of conventional truth, the Mahayana brought about, as it were, an easing of tension between the transcendental and the mundane, with a consequent weakening of the impulse for the attainment of one by the renunciation of the other. There does not seem to be much point in giving up the world when it is only God in disguise. If the Mahayana retained the monastic life, it was for the same reason that it retained the Hinayana teaching, namely that the relative truth is the indispensable stepping stone to the absolute truth. In the spiritual life, there are no shortcuts. When, in the last stages of its career in India, certain pseudo-tantric schools, forgetting this teaching, tried to make direct application of the doctrine of non-duality on the relative plane without first realizing its importance, the result was speedy degeneration and collapse. The second reason for this lessening of the difference between monks and laymen, namely that all beings are potentially Buddhas, is the logical corollary of the Bodhisattva ideal, as universalized by the Mahayana. All beings should traverse the 10 stages of the Bodhisattva's career. All should aim at supreme Buddhahood for the sake of all sentient beings. All, in fact, will attain supreme Buddhahood. However distant the day of enlightenment may be, dawn it must for everyone, even if after the lapse of aeons impossible to enumerate. Translated from the language of time into the language of eternity, this means that speaking metaphysically, or from the standpoint of the highest truth, all beings are even now the Buddha, however unaware they may be of the fact. The only difference between the Buddha and an ordinary man is that the former knows he is the Buddha, whereas the latter does not. As the Ratna Gotravibhaga says, "The element of Tathagahood, as it is present in all, is immutable, and cannot be affected by either defilement or purification. Like the Buddha in a faded lotus flower, like honey covered by a swarm of bees, like the kernel of a fruit in the husk, like gold within impurities, like a treasure hidden in the soil, the fruit in a small seed, an image of the jinnah in tattered garments, the universal monarch in the vile belly of a woman, and like a precious statue covered with dust, so is this element established in beings who are covered with the stains of adventitious defilements." Ratna Gotravibhaga, 1, 96-7, Khonsa's translation. Both monk and layman, being equally the Buddha, it is impossible to assert the superiority of one over the other, except in a purely social and conventional sense. Though even in the Mahayana, especially as it exists in Tibet, the spiritual community and the ecclesiastical corporation to some extent overlap, the general effect of the doctrines of non-duality and immanent Buddha nature was to shift the centre of gravity in Buddhist societies from the second to the first, with a consequent diminution of the importance of the monastic order and the monastic life. Moreover, whereas in Hinayana lands the individual monk is submerged in the Sangha, which is treated as though it possessed a life and individuality independent of that of its members, in Mahayana lands it is certain leading members of the Sangha who, in their individual capacities and by virtue of their transcendental attainments, occupy the foreground of the picture as religious teachers and spiritual guides. Such are Nagarjuna, Ashvaghosha, Asanga, Vasubandhu, Huensang, Atisha, Milarepa, Kobudashi, Tsongkhapa, and a host of others whose prestige and influence were, in the eyes of the Mahayana public, in no way contingent upon the fact that they had received monastic ordination. Again, whereas in the Hinayana schools all lineages, in the sense of the various lines of pupillary succession through which the teaching has been handed down, are traced back to the Shakyamuni, that is to say to the Buddha's Nimanakaya, in the Mahayana schools they are sometimes traced back to his Sambhogakaya. Thus Asanga, the co-founder with his brother Vasubandhu of the Yogacara, is traditionally supposed to have received the distinctive teachings of this school from the Bodhisattva Maitreya, while the apostolical succession of the Kagyu school of Tibetan Buddhism descends through Tilopa, its first human guru, directly from the Vajradhara Buddha. The continued spiritual vitality of the Mahayana is largely due to the fact that again and again there welled up within it inspiration from these transcendental sources, which even today are by no means exhausted. Each and every founder of the numerous schools and sub-schools of the Mahayana was a channel for the transmission of the wisdom and compassion of the Buddha to mankind, and each, while taking up his stand upon these distinctive teachings of the Mahayana, which were common to all its branches, at the same time developed his special doctrines and methods in accordance with the current requirements of sentient beings. What these special doctrines and methods were, it will be our business to see in the next chapter.